Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks, a recent acquisition of grown trees leads to a city-owned tree farm.
Plus, Ozarks heads to the small screen. We go behind the scenes of a local television network's news production.
But first, from the shutdown of an area bridge to the private option, Timothy Dennis has more in this week's Week in Review.
It's been a varied week in terms of what stories have made headlines. First, let's talk about taxes. At its meeting this week, the Crawford County Quorum Court agreed to pursue a 1/2% increase to the county sales tax. That increase would entail a 1/4-cent sales tax hike to pay for construction of a new county jail, as well as a 1/4-cent increase that would pay for operations of the facility once it's built. County Judge John Hall says that the county is in dire need of a new facility to house detainees.
Our jail is 25 years old. It's outdated. We've had some problems with even being certified with the state, and we've also run out of room, and it's overcrowded. It's got lots of problems, and we're going to go out. We're just going to go build a new one and try to and make it 3 times as large, and it'll meet all the state standards, and it'll be certified, and we will be able to handle our own people here in the county. Right now, we've got a great big portion of them in other people's jails.
That includes some detainees being held at the Washington County Detention Center. Though county voters have thrice rejected similar proposed sales tax increases, Hall is encouraged by the recent success of a similar sales tax vote in Yale County.
We're doing something a little different. We're going to put this thing on the primary election ballot, which will let everybody that comes to vote in the primary election will have an opportunity to vote for or against this thing. So this is not going to be a special election where just a certain the beginners come out or the four people come out. This is going to be on a general election ballot where you will have thousands of people will come to vote. And when they're voting, they'll also be voting on this issue. So it's a little different, approach, and we're going to see what happens.
The Quorum Court will formally approve the sales tax issue next month. The primary election and vote on the sales tax issue will be held on Tuesday, May 20th. The county currently levies a 1% sales tax, which has been in effect for more than a decade. Also in the River Valley this week, officials with the Arkansas and Missouri Railroad were determining the cause of a failed bridge raising mechanism this week after a pair of cables malfunctioned and left one end of the bridge raised. Ron Sparks is the chief of the railroad's police force, and he is managing the repair efforts at the Arkansas River Bridge near Van Buren.
Of course, this bridge was built in 1969, and those cables have been there since then. But they are maintained and lubricated and things of that nature on an annual basis at least. And then they are inspected, and we inspect the bridge monthly. But we don't know yet what caused the cables to break. Our engineers and specialists are still trying to determine that. The status today is we have manpower and parts and equipment and heavy equipment here. We have more equipment coming to be in the water as far as barges and cranes to help us get this bridge up so that we can resume river traffic, of course, is a big issue, and then the train traffic as well.
He says that a bridge malfunction like this is unusual for the railroad.
Well, I've been here 16 years, and this has never happened since I've been here, and I don't know of it happening any time since we've owned this bridge, nothing to this degree, which we've had it for going on 28 years. So we haven't experienced anything like this. You know, occasionally things will go wrong with it, but it's usually an electronical problem or something we can fix fairly quickly. Nothing that stops river traffic or rail traffic, because the bridge can be mainly ran from a motor that's on top of the bridge, even if the electronics go out. So we have ways to operate it. This is the first time we've had this kind of an issue that I know of.
Although dealing with a bridge malfunction of this magnitude is new to the railroad, Sparks estimated it would take about a week for the necessary repair work to be completed, provided that no other problems were encountered in the process. But not every headline came from Crawford County this week. The bounds of development in downtown Bentonville are set to spread in coming years after the city's planning commission last week approved a master plan for the southeast downtown area. Troy Galloway, Bentonville Planning Services Director, says that the master plan grew out of a scarcity of space for further development in the roughly 5-block area surrounding the central downtown square.
This particular plan in the southeast part of town gives us an opportunity to develop a couple of districts, one being a market district, the other an arts district, and an opportunity to fold in a wider variety of residential densities in and around the southeast part of downtown so that we have, in the end, an expanded downtown that is much more capable of serving a growing population and just the smaller confined area in and around the square.
Galloway says that the Southeast Downtown Master Plan is an extension of the rapid development that has already happened in Bentonville's downtown area.
I'll use the Arts District as an example. ERC Development out of Fort Smith has committed to do a 60-unit apartment building that's on the north edge of the Arts District. And so that will give us some additional residential density in the Arts District that will also benefit the Market District long term. And we have private developers that have already acquired properties in the Market District, one being the old Tyson plant and one being the old Kraft plant, and they're in the process of repurposing those properties for development as well.
The Bentonville City Council will discuss the plan Tuesday evening. If aldermen approve the plan, it will become an adopted plan for the city. After that, Galloway says that the city will undertake a few water, sewer, and sidewalk infrastructure projects in order to support additional development in the area. And finally, a common thread throughout the week's news was talk in Little Rock of Arkansas's private option expansion of Medicaid. Governor Mike Beebe says that if lawmakers decide to drop the private option, they'll have to decide what else to cut to bridge a shortfall in the state's budget. The governor appeared Thursday night on AETN's Arkansans Ask program and said that the budget shortfall is compounded by a tax cut set to take effect July 1st, a tax cut originally based on expected revenue created because of the private option.
All of that's predicated on the fact that you've got that money from the private option to pay for that. If you don't have that money, what are you going to do? Are you going to repeal those tax cuts? I don't think so. If you don't repeal the tax cuts and you don't do the private option, continue where it is now, then you've got an $86 million hole in the budget that you've got to fix.
Opponents of the private option often cite one problem with the program as extremely low reimbursement rates to physician specialists by big insurance providers like Blue Cross Blue Shield. Beebe said that he's very optimistic the problem will be fixed soon. From the Harold and Blanche Kalk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
Last week, Springdale landscape crews removed over 100 trees along Don Tyson Parkway at the request of Johnny Tyson, who paid to replace them with all maple trees in an effort to have a more consistent flowering come spring and color in the fall. But what to do with the removed trees? The city of Springdale used this situational opportunity to launch a tree farm. I visited with some Springdale officials to find out that this is something they'd been thinking about for some time.
Now set your regulars, put your bucket down.
A crew of eight used a backhoe to replant the 105 lacebark elm, sycamore, and Chinese pistache trees on a portion of a 7-acre plot of land on the east side of Springdale.
We've always wanted to start a tree farm, but we're always looking for the right place.
That's Sam Goad, Director of Public Works for the City of Springdale. He said the perfect location needed to be secure and have water available. This is something the city hadn't thought too much about until this unique opportunity to remove existing trees from Don Tyson Parkway came about, leaving them responsible for their roots. This tract of land is known as the McCullough Site. The north side of the land is being used for one of two community gardens in Springdale. But the south side, or back end of this property, is an area well suited for the tree farm, and it was empty. Goad says a city-owned tree farm should prove to be both cost-effective and efficient.
We have a lot of trees planted around town that are subject to damage from traffic from time to time. And when they get a size, say a 3 or 4 inch diameter, when they get hit by a car, reacquiring a suitable tree of the correct species and size can sometimes be a lengthy endeavor. So our hope is to generate an inventory of trees at the tree farm to where Mike and his crew can go out, select a tree that they need, and transplant it from the tree farm to the location desired.
Mike Hickson is Springdale's landscape supervisor. He agrees that having trees in various sizes available to the city at any time will be less expensive than ordering full-grown trees from an outside company.
If you've got the ground to grow them in, you're going to save the city some money whenever they've got to have trees, because year after year they just continue to get larger, and then when you've got large trees available, you've got a situation where your investment in a small tree may have been $10 or maybe not even that much. When they get to be to a 2 to 4 inch caliber tree, you're looking at a cost of a tree when we order one out of a nursery or something like that, being anywhere from $125 to $250.
Hickson says that this is just one of the advantages. With the land already in place, a drip irrigation system will be installed. Once that is in place, very little time will be needed for maintenance of the trees, as watering will be done automatically. Once this is complete, in the next month or so, Hickson plans to acquire some very colorful and unique seedlings. Seedlings that are no more than 2 feet tall and skinny enough to resemble a whip.
A lot of different kinds of unique deciduous trees that have been imported from different places around the world, especially Asia, that grow in the same climates that we've got here, but they're just not native to this area. And so some of them are very decorative and very ornate. You know, you buy them as a very small seedling, and you plant it in a 1 gallon container, and then eventually begin to move it up as it grows, you know, over time. And so that's kind of something we're looking forward to, is doing a little experimenting with that as well.
Each spring for the last 6 years, Springdale has planted 400 to 600 seedlings as part of the Illinois River Watershed Partnership's riparian project. And Sam Goad sees many more trees being planted within the city's limits in the near future.
Another advantage of having the tree farm is the Razorback Greenway that's being constructed through Springdale. I believe our length through Springdale is approximately 9 miles. And along that trail will be trees that are planted for beautification. And those trees over time will need to be replaced for various reasons. So having the tree farm, and with trees, as Mike has identified, unusual trees not native to this area, then we'll have an opportunity to plant along the trail, either new or as replacement trees, and get some unusual varieties for people to enjoy as they walk and bike along the trail.
Sam Goad is the Director of Public Works for the City of Springdale. Mike Hickson is the city's landscape supervisor. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
This spring, you can get up close to a copy of the first public printing of President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. You can closely study a 1350 copy of the Magna Carta, see a 17th century Italian edition of Marco Polo's account of his journey across Asia 400 years before, or hold a page from a Gutenberg Bible. These documents and many others are part of a collection on display through early May at Mullins Library at the University of Arkansas. The exhibit, free and open to the public, is on loan from the Remnant Trust in Indiana. Some of the earliest copies of works by Thomas Paine, Mary Wollstonecraft, and Thomas Jefferson are included. This week, I talked to Molly Boyd, assistant to the Dean of Libraries at the University of Arkansas, about the rare pieces of history on campus this semester. The assortment represents a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to experience language and ideas.
Exactly. We're excited, too. The materials that are collected here from the Remnant Trust, in most cases, is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see and even touch these original works.
Well, let's talk about that word touch, because that's something the Remnant Trust talks about in their material, that this is an idea that you can touch. So what does that mean? What can people do with these documents at Mullins Library?
Well, it's not that they can just toss them around, but we are going to provide a 2 hours a day where we have staff on hand that will allow them to take the materials out of the cases one at a time and just look through them, see what they see. And there's so much to see in the actual physical item that you don't see from just the text online, let's say.
So, boy, it's a lot of different things here. From the 17th, 16th, 15th century. This goes back to the printed word's earliest days.
Not only that, but the earliest days of language. We have some terracotta pieces that have cuneiform written on them. So those are 4,000 years old.
Wow. A page from a Gutenberg Bible?
Yes, we have that. Just one page, and the Remnant Trust says it's really hard to calculate how, you know, if they're, what the value of that is, because it's so rare, being the first printed book.
How are they're here for the majority of this semester. How are you allowing people to interact with them? Where are they at this time?
The materials are located in Mullins Library in an exhibit. They're, you can look at it at any time. The cases are locked. But 2 hours during the weekdays, we have staff on hand to unlock the cases at the request of patrons and to show these materials and allow them just to explore them. They have different bindings, different printings. Some of them are, of course, handwritten manuscripts. The materials on which they made these vary from rice paper to parchment to vellum. So it's very interesting to see all of those variations, as well as there it is. There's the specific, you know, King James Version of the Bible, first printing.
Oh, my gosh. How did this come about? How did you make connection to the Remnant Trust?
A professor of social work, Scott Bertram, had seen this exhibit in Mississippi, and he came to the Dean of Libraries, Carolyn Allen, and asked her, can we please get this here, because it is really a life-changing experience to hold these things in your hands. And she agreed, and we pursued it.
How did they arrive? I mean, I have this vision of people in white gloves and very carefully bringing things in from an armored van. Am I over-romanticizing?
You are indeed.
No.
The head of the trust, Chris Becks, brought them personally, and he brought them by truck.
Just like
here's a couple of boxes of priceless books. Of course, they're packed in specially made boxes for each piece, and then packed again in other boxes, so it's fairly secure.
There is an opportunity for people to learn more about some of the subjects and some of the actual documents that are here. You're going to have a series of conversations or lectures too, right?
We're very fortunate that the professors at the university really took on this idea and have made it their own. We've got a number of lectures where professors are going to talk about the significance of a work or an era or a topic that's related to one or more of the materials in the exhibit.
This is a spectacular collection. How do you know much about how the Remnant Trust began their quest to collect ideas?
They have a manifesto that has to do with freedom and liberty, and from a very American perspective. So they started with things like Thomas Paine and the Articles of Confederation. But as they began to collect those materials, they started thinking of other opportunities to collect ideas that changed the way we viewed the world. And specifically, that has to do with freedom of thought, freedom of expression. So we have Galileo and Copernicus in the exhibit as a good example of that idea.
You mentioned, we've talked about the Gutenberg Bible, the King James Version, but there is an Egyptian scroll fragment of the Torah from 17th, 16th century, a manuscript of the Quran from the late 18th century, a 16th century copy of the Illustrated Life of Confucius. I mean, this, you can't sum up the world, perhaps, in one exhibit, but you can make a pretty good dent.
Some really nice cultures that are represented there, and we do have one of the professor lectures is going to talk about the Illustrated Life of Confucius, which there again, Confucius didn't create his own works. Works were written about him after he was deceased. But this is a lovely example of an illustrated manuscript from China.
As you and I talk, the exhibit has been open for just a few hours. Have you had a chance to look at the material yet?
Yes, very much so.
What's that like?
It's wonderful. From the bookworm holes that you see in some of the books to the different bindings, to there's actually one work that was printed but was never illuminated. So there are like big gaps before every paragraph where the initial letter was supposed to be drawn in, but that part was never done. There's a book in there that's never been cut, so the pages are just printed and aligned, but then the edges are just seems like a random accumulation of different size pieces of paper.
This is free, right?
It is.
People can bring their family and look
yes,
at this.
Yes, and we would love to have them do that. It's free and open to the public. You can come see the materials at any time the library is open, which is from generally 7 a.m. in the morning till 2 a.m. at night. But we only have staff on hand 2 hours a day to open the cases and allow you to look at the materials hands-on.
Molly Boyd is the assistant to the Dean of Libraries at the University of Arkansas. This week, an exhibit of rare documents from the Remnant Trust was installed inside Mullins Library and will remain on display during library hours until early May. The exhibit is free and open to the public. You can learn more about the exhibit and the opportunities to inspect the documents closer by going to the website libinfo.uark.edu. That's libinfo.uark.edu. Then follow the exhibits link.
This Week in This American Life. A storage container filled with somebody else's stuff. Can't go inside or touch it.
Oh my God.
So back there.
It looks empty.
No, there's someone living back there.
But you can look and bid on what you think it's worth.
There's somebody's hair. There's a head in there.
There's a shrunken head right there.
What it's like to actually make a living doing this, guessing, this week.
This American Life begins next at 10 after the conclusion of Ozarks at Large.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Not everything is made in our listening area. There are some things that are not made here.
No. Well, there are a lot of things that are made here.
Exactly. And as we continue our once-a-month series on locally made, we found out that some of those objects that direct you one place or another are also made here.
The one-woman business of Sleet City Hand-Painted Signs has only been around for just over a year, yet Olivia Trimble's products have been all over, including a banner that was hung outside the town center in Fayetteville for the Little Craft Show, and a sandwich board for Onyx Coffee Lab. Olivia realized that she could make a business of painting signs after she bought her stepfather, a lifelong sign painter, Eric Snodgrass of Snodgrass Signs, a book for Christmas.
It was a combination of me sort of trying out some different little flea market booth ideas. So I was doing furniture and it was going really well. And when I would look at like things like Pinterest, I would see signs that people were making. So I thought, well, I can maybe do that. So I tried it, and I really liked it. And so I did, like, the arts and crafts signs for quite a while, just for friends and for, like, teeny tiny little events. And then they started getting popular. So I went to buy my stepdad a Christmas gift, and there was this new book that was out called Sign Painters, and it was all about all of these old school women and men who have painted signs. I read it before I gave it to him, and I sort of became obsessed. I wanted to learn the process. I wanted to use nice brushes, and I wanted to use enamel instead of just, you know, craft paint. I've just sort of latched onto it. It's kind of all I want to do.
Sleet City Hand-Painted Signs is based out of Olivia's home in the south side of Fayetteville, where she lives with her husband and two young children. The studio? Her garage. She credits staying home with her two young children for helping her realize that she could make hand-painted signs her livelihood.
I've tried a few different things. I took some classes at the U of A and went to hair school for a while, and nothing really seemed very interesting. And all the while, I was staying at home with our two daughters, Eleanor and Callie. And so it just occurred to me that, like, sign painting is a trade. It's something that people have to take a long time to learn. So, like, what better time for me to figure out what I want to do and start learning it than now?
Right now, Olivia is working on a custom order for a good friend. It's a sign painted on barn wood where she's made a custom sign frame. The quote she is painting onto the rough surface of barn wood comes from a Kris Kristofferson song. My thirsty wanted whiskey, but my hungry needed beans.
I basically have printed the paper pattern to fit her sign. I've chalked the back and laid her pattern down on the sign, and I'm basically just tracing the line so that I have a guide for when I paint. There are some jobs where I would do something freehand, but for this specific project, we decided on a specific look, and we're just sticking with it. I'll be using one-shot lettering enamel on the sign, and I'll be using my sign painting lettering quills, and the kind that I use are matte brushes. A lot of times when I pull up the pattern and expect to see my chalk outline underneath, I just have to go off of indentations in the wood, so there's some of that on the sign today. The way that lettering enamel works is that you thin it with paint thinner. So that's what I'll be doing next. I'm gonna test this paint out and see how it works on our barn wood here. So my brushes are made from squirrel tail. So every time I clean them and put them up, they are, I guess, conditioned with oil. Every time I pull a brush out to paint, I have to clean it with paint thinner. So my workshop's pretty smelly place. Painting on barn wood is always a challenge. The texture is just crazy. If it were smooth, it might go a little faster, but because I'm taking the texture into consideration, it takes a little more coaxing to get the enamel down into the grooves of this wood. There are some signs that I can do very quickly, but my work time is usually about anywhere from 35 minutes to an hour for a medium-sized piece like this. But that doesn't really take into consideration like the design and layout, and then if I have to actually construct anything.
This sign Olivia's wrapping up will go to a private home, but you can check out her wares at the Four-Legged Bird in Fayetteville. That's at the Archibald Yell S Curve. Also, check her out on Facebook at Sleet City Decor. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Katie Henriksen.
It was wintertime in Nashville, down on Music City Road. I was looking for a place to get myself out of the cold, to warm the frozen feeling that was eating at my soul, keep the chilly wind off of my guitar. My thirsty wanted whiskey, my hungry needed beans. But it's been a month of paydays since I'd heard.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Earlier this week, our colleague Antoinette Grajeda took us behind the scenes at KNWA, Northwest Arkansas's NBC affiliate. Here's that report.
Bush at Dark Canyon, with the proceeds going to Caring and Sharing of Northwest Arkansas. We caught up with him this afternoon in an interview you'll only see on KNWA.
In order for Neely Jones to anchor the 5 o'clock news at KNWA, work at the Fayetteville-based NBC affiliate must begin hours before the live broadcast starts. KNWA used to be located on the Fayetteville Square, where passersby could catch a glimpse of the studio through the glass storefront. In October of 2012, the station moved into its new home on the third floor of the Dixon in Fayetteville. Brooke Thomas is the news director at KNWA. A typical day for him begins between 8:30 and 9 a.m. Upon arriving, he touches base with the morning crew before the day shift starts to trickle in. Thomas's office is located on the north side of the newsroom. This room is comprised of one long row of desks and another shorter one positioned perpendicularly nearby. There are low partitions between each desk. The hum of police scanners can be heard coming from an elevated area in the corner of the room called the assignments desk.
740, King Charles William.
The open layout of the room is intentional, Thomas explains, because it allows everyone to communicate openly and easily, and it cuts down on a lot of communication barriers. At 9:45 a.m., the first of two editorial meetings begins inside a conference room located on the south side of the newsroom. One wall has been painted to be a dry erase board where ideas are jotted down. During this meeting, reporters pitch their ideas for stories, and once assignments are handed out, they go out into the field to conduct interviews. Thomas explains some days there is the obvious big story that needs to be covered. On days when there isn't that big story, one of the things they consider is their audience's interests. Staff members ask themselves, based on the audience watching the show airing prior to the newscast, what would they be most interested in hearing about? Reporters then try to tell the audience something related to that. For a television station, ratings are something to be considered. Every quarter, some viewers are asked to document what they watch and when in a ratings book. Once the data is analyzed, ratings are awarded, and that's what advertising sales are based on. Thomas says this is typically the way the revenue side of the business is done.
Fortunately, in the news department, we don't have to even deal with the revenue side of it, but the thing that we are tasked with is making sure that the product we're putting on the air generates a certain rating point in order to gain enough audience so that the sales side of the revenue side of it can actually sell ads and we can keep the lights on. It is a business, and you know, we do have to try to make sure that we are gainfully employed. So that is part of it. But the other half of it is that, you know, we do employ a room full of professionals who actually care about what they're doing, and the idea that our product is going to be the best product that we can put on every single day is much more important to us, a lot more important to us. You know, we can worry about the revenue side all day long, but if we're not caring about the actual service that we're providing to our community, then I think we're hypocrites.
While the morning reporters are conducting interviews in the field, producers stay at the station and begin organizing content and writing scripts for the early evening shows. The night crew starts coming in around 1 in the afternoon, and a second editorial meeting occurs at 1:30. While a new batch of reporters heads out on assignments, the first set of reporters comes back and starts writing stories, and photographers begin editing video. John Cumston has been a photographer in the area for more than a decade. He says producing stories works best when there is a close collaboration between a reporter and a photographer.
The reporter should always feel like they can suggest shots to the photographer. Photographers should always feel like they could step in and ask a question in an interview or guide the story in a way that might not, you know, you might not think of just based on photography. So it's, we try in our management here supports very much a very sort of egalitarian posture between reporter and photographer. We don't say my reporter, my photographer. We avoid language like that because we think it promotes teamwork.
If you walk down a hallway and through a pair of doors located to the west of the newsroom, you'll find yourself in the control room. There are several televisions located at the front of this room. In fact, with televisions in virtually every room in the building, news director Brooke Thomas estimates there are more than 40 televisions inside KNWA. Inside the control room, there are three approximately 60-inch television screens hanging side by side, and each one is equipped with multi-view. One monitor has 8 smaller screens on it, while the remaining 2 have 10 smaller screens on it. Those smaller screens show the station's different sources. For example, on one monitor, you may be able to see a shot of the main anchor at her desk, the chief meteorologist at his station, and another reporter who's standing outside. There is also a preview screen that allows the crew to view a shot prior to sending it out live over the air. Positioned above those three large televisions is a digital atomic clock, and above that are 8 smaller televisions. Thomas explains those show other TV stations so the staff can keep track of what's happening in the world, even while they're airing their own show. The control room has 3 tiers of desks arranged in stadium seating. The first and lowest desk, which is located at the front of the room, contains the director's board. The director sits at the right side of the desk and pushes buttons on this board to control what video is sent out over the air.
4, 3, 2, 1, roll rejoiner.
He is also in charge of launching commercials during breaks. The graphics operator is located to his left, and his area contains 6 different computer monitors. The director places images created by the graphics department over video, but he must organize this all prior to it being broadcast.
So as it's happening live, what you see at home, they've actually been building for the last 5-6 seconds. So they're having to constantly work ahead, which is where the producers writing the shows come into play, because they're scripting everything. So the directors are reading actual physical scripts and understanding what is coming next so that they can keep moving ahead and keep ahead of the show. they're not necessarily flying by the seat of their pants. It's all scripted.
The producer is positioned behind the director on a second tier. The producer has a rundown program on a computer where the script is located, and in addition to writing the script for the show, the producer is also in charge of making sure the show fits within the allotted amount of time. This means instructing on-air talent to talk longer or perhaps talk quicker if necessary. That communication can happen when reporters wear earpieces that allow them to hear a producer's instructions.
Neely, I'm going to cut down the Super Bowl script. And again, Dan has a quick 30 and 15.
The teleprompter is run by someone sitting to the left of the producer. It's their job to make sure the text is moving at the speed necessary for a reporter to read it. The audio station is located on the third and final tier. While there are speakers located at the front of the control room, this tier has its own set of speakers, so the audio engineer can hear better and make sure the audio is clean. It also allows him to hear things that aren't on the air. For example, he can place a reporter preparing to speak in cue, which means only he can hear the reporter. This allows him to test the reporter's audio levels before sending his voice live over the air. Upon exiting the control room and walking through another set of doors, you'll find yourself in the news studio. The first set that greets you is the weather desk. A typical day for Chief Meteorologist Dan Scoff begins between 1:30 and 2 in the afternoon. He works until about 11 at night, but says sometimes he gets a break between shows where he can eat dinner with his family. The Weather Center has 9 computers, which Scoff says all have a different purpose. During severe weather, Scoff's day can start earlier and perhaps go later, depending on the weather system. He says he's there till it's over and has on occasion seen the sunrise. On a typical day, one of his tasks includes doing research and creating his own forecast. He says it can be a complicated process that can take more than 2 hours to calculate.
And if one little thing is off 4 or 5 days out when you're trying to forecast exactly how much it's going to snow on someone's house, if the system drifts, 30 miles farther north, your whole forecast changes. So it's complicated, but it's a challenge, and it's a challenge that I love, because it's just like I'm trying to beat the weather and figure out what's happening.
The Northwest Arkansas Weather Authority set is one of 4 sets located in the news studio. The other sets include the KNWA set and a green wall that's used for weather forecasts. The 4 set has a blue backdrop and is the set for the Fox News Edge, which airs on KNWA's sister station. News director Brooke Thomas explains the sets were built into the corners of the room to give depth and to fill the wide shots that come with filming in high definition. He says the news studio space is twice the size of their old location, but that's not even including the sports set, which is located in an adjacent room. The station as a whole has less space than their previous location, but Thomas says it feels like more space because they were able to design this space to fit their specific needs. The sets are on wheels, as are 2 cameras, which allows all of these items to be moved about the studio. The cameras are equipped with teleprompters so anchors can read their scripts, as well as a flat screen so they can see what's being shown on air. Walking through another set of doors, you'll find yourself in the sports studio. The studio has 1 large table and several workstations along the wall and 1 camera, although the other 2 cameras can be wheeled in from the new studio. The Razorback Nation staff consists of 5 members, and in addition to broadcasting in Northwest Arkansas, the team also does sports for a television station in Little Rock. The sports team also produces a 30-minute weekend show called The Pig Trail that airs around the state. Aaron Peters is the Razorback Nation anchor.
It's unique to any other place I've seen. One thing about the job is they have us traveling all over to all sorts of different affiliates, so you really get a good perspective of what other sports departments do and how much effort they put into sports and the commitment level they put into sports. And ours is up there toward the top. I've been to San Francisco and Dallas and New York and Tampa, and none of them treat sports quite like this because their view on it is that you can get what you need from ESPN or Fox or wherever, whereas here, Arkansas, it's a finite brand of sports. It's the Razorbacks, and a lot of times, especially if they're not doing well, they won't be on ESPN at all. So to get your fix on your Razorbacks, you got to turn to local sports.
After exiting the sports studio, you walk past the lobby, and as you circle back to the newsroom, you'll notice a break room tucked away behind a conference room. News director Brooke Thomas says they didn't have a break room in their previous location. However, the break room isn't always available, as it is now often the site where they film their newly launched cooking show called Cooking Today.
That's part of, I think, the environment that is bred here, which is, you know, we see a challenge and then we like to rise to it and say, okay, here's something we've never done before, so let's go out and just try to do it. And this is an example of something that we have literally never done. We have no idea what we don't know. We've just started, and here we go, and now I think we're going to learn a whole lot, and I think it'll be a success.
Local news airs at 5, 6, and 10 weeknights on KNWA and at 5:30 and 9 on Fox 24. For more information, you can visit nwahomepage.com.
It is Sunday, January 26, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us on this edition of Weekend Ozarks is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
One of the fun things at the Shiloh Museum, and you know I love the Shiloh Museum, there's absolutely no denying that.
A lot of the things are fun.
A lot of the things are fun, but they have a collection of paintings by a folk artist named Essie Ward.
Yes.
She got really popular at the end of the 60s, I believe.
A lot of it's farm life and rural life,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And they're very sort of crude looking folk art.
I don't know if simple is the right word, but
is she local or?
She lived over around Marshall.
Okay.
On top of a mountain.
Searcy County.
Mm-hmm. And her work came to like national prominence. She was invited to the Smithsonian to a folk art festival.
Because there was this sort of boom in folk art at the time.
Exactly. That's when, if you see all of the little carvings that are very rustic, that's the time those came from. Well, the Shiloh Museum has a new show of her work opening Monday. And you're going to get to see a different side of Essie Ward.
Because they part of the permanent collection are some of those paintings that are on the one wall when you walk into.
Right.
Right.
And they have 59, which is the biggest collection of her work as far as we know.
Wow.
But now they've borrowed paintings from her grandson, whose name is Daryl Maynard. He lives in Yellville. And he grew up on the mountain with Grandma Essie and her husband 2 miles that way and his Maynard grandparents spitting distance the other way. And life was very much for him, even, he's 63, the way it was depicted in her paintings. You know, he went over and helped take up hay using horses or mules. One set of grandparents used mules, except when they had tickle grass in the hay. And then you had to use horses because the horses walk faster. It makes the blades move faster, and it would cut through tickle grass, which was some awful thing that got in your clothes and made you itch.
I don't want it.
Yeah.
I'm not interested.
It's just all really fascinating. And he talks about his grandmother deciding, Essie decided she wanted a car. Everybody had a car. She wanted a car. And that came to an end after she took out a couple of fence rows. So the car went down and stayed at his mom and dad's, and they took her, or when he was old enough, he took her. And they all played outside, and she also sculpted in clay that came from the farm, including an entire buffalo hunt that had riders on horses and buffalo with the arrows sticking out of them and dogs running along. And if anybody knows what happened to that piece, he hasn't seen it since it was sold. And he thinks it was to a doctor, and he thinks it was in Marshall. If anybody knows what happened to that piece, he would love to see it again. Anyway, you need to go and check out this exhibit. It opens Monday. It's on through January 10th of 2015, so you've got some time.
Okay.
Museum hours are 10 to 5 Monday through Saturday, and it is free.
Sounds like a good time.
And you might also want to look ahead to another local artist's success. A musician named Barrett Baber.
Oh, yeah.
Antoinette had him in the Furman Garner Performance Studio.
And he has won. You may have seen stuff about the voting for CBS Interactive's Grammy Gig of a Lifetime contest, and he won. And on Thursday, he opened for Los Angeles-based alt-rock quintet, The Neighborhood, at a concert at Club Nokia. And part of those performances will be seen online all day today as part of the preview to tonight's Grammy Awards.
Wow.
When I talked to him Tuesday, he was cruising Los Angeles in a limousine with his band, and they were taking pictures at landmarks for this CBS Interactive thing.
Oh,
so
cool.
A lot of fun. He teaches drama at Fayetteville High School, actually debate and forensics. Local kid. And if you go online to either CBS.com or Grammy.com, you can see Barrett Baber and you can prepare for the Grammys, which will be shown at 7 o'clock tonight.
There you go.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Joaquin Phoenix doesn't love being interviewed.
You don't deserve this. You honestly, you deserve somebody who really enjoys talking about themselves.
But on the next Fresh Air Weekend, Phoenix talks about his films, his approach to acting, and about staging an elaborate hoax in which he claimed to quit acting to become a rapper. He stars in the new film, Her. Join us.
Stay tuned to KUAF. Fresh Air will begin this evening at 6 on 91.3 FM.
Last night, Eureka Springs based band SX Rex played to a crowd at the Ozark Mountain Music Festival. We heard from them prior to that performance on Friday's edition of Ozarks at Large. But what we didn't hear was this song.
This next song is called Am I Coming Through? Thank you.
brothers Josh, Chris, and Nick Bauer, who together make up the band SX Rex. Now of Eureka Springs, the brothers grew up in Colorado.
Okay, mentioning Colorado, Christina.
Right.
It figures into our Sunday montage.
It does.
Because the Super Bowl, which is a week from tonight, is between the Denver Broncos and the Seattle Seahawks. So I thought, let's do montages of both cities.
Right. But today,
we'll do Denver and Colorado. So okay. This is a montage devoted to the city of Denver and the state of Colorado. See how many of these you can identify.
I've been trying to do it right. I've been living a lonely life. I've been sleeping here instead. I've been sleeping in my bed. Sleeping in my bed.
Who are you?
I am Ork from Ork. Nanu Nanu.
Hey, he's still alive. Kyle, you okay? I think so. Is Carmen up there?
I'm right here, Kyle.
A sky full of Rockies for my roof up there. A great golden meadow for my rocking chair. A claim and a cabin and some breathing air. Colorado, my home.
That's an ugly implication.
You came back to hurt my husband. First in court, and now by moving in. All right, that's your business. Maybe your disease. But my business is to protect my husband. His peace of mind, for one thing. I don't have to tell you what he's been through.
There's a place where eagles speak, and the sunrise slides from peak to peak, where the air is crisp and the water's clear, and there's just one beer that's brewed up here.
A musician, a dreamer, a man of great strength, courage, and deep faith. Johnny Cash, this is your life.
He was born in the summer of his 27th year, coming home to a place he'd never been before. He left yesterday behind. Might say he found the key for every door.
To see how you did on our Sunday morning Denver and Colorado montage, go to our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Rocky Mountain.
How fitting.
Yes.
Where is it?
Rocky Mountains in the Ouachita National Forest, south of Mena, and it is slightly, I guess you would say, northeast of Vandervoort.
Vandervoort.
Yes.
Right. Totally in our listening area.
We have on the edge.
Right. We have a translator in Mena.
Yes.
Right.
So I'm sure on top of Rocky Mountain, which is almost 2,000 feet above sea level, you'd hear it.
You can. That's right. Well, Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums. You're all by your lonesome tomorrow.
I am. You guys, you and Antoinette will be working on stories or something.
That's what we tell you.
Right.
Yes. And then Antoinette and myself on Tuesday. You and I back together on Thursday.
That's right.
All right.
Until then.
Have a very good Sunday.